Today, we look back on our favorite books of 2012. Joining us, Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library. Good morning, Jill.
Good morning.
And Melanie Lowers, books editor at the Cape Cod Times. Good morning, Melanie.
Good morning, Mindy.
Let's get right into it. Melanie, why don't we start? We've got a whole lot of books here.
We have a whole lot of books. I think that one of the things that struck me when I was looking back at what I had read this year that I really appreciated was that there was very few 2012. I'm still going through 2010, 2011. I think I'm always dragging a little bit behind because I can't get them right at the time when they come out. But it's that buildup of word of mouth and friends reading and awards and things like that. And eventually I go, I really need to read this. But here's a book in which as soon as I unpacked it at work and saw the cover, I knew I had to read it. And I think all my sense of this book has been justified. And it was Behind the Beautiful Forevers by Catherine Boo, who was the winner of the National Book Award for Nonfiction and also a previous Pulitzer Prize winner for reporting. This is a book set in the slums of Mumbai. This is Slumdog Millionaire, if you remember that story, without the happy ending. And the setting is the Anawadi slum that sits right next to the Mumbai airport, which is ultra modern and peopled by an international jet set and India's wealthiest and the movers and shakers of Indian and world society. But behind a poster, it's kind of a fence. For a condominium development called the Beautiful Forevers lies this vast Anawadi slum. And this particular story is, it's all true, is about a boy named Abdul. He's a Muslim boy who has dreams of wanting to better his life and better his family's life. And over the course of the book, you meet the people he has the most constant congress with, family members, friends, neighbors, that kind of thing. And it is a scratch world. People will do anything they can to get anything and to survive a day. And this boy who has such wonderful dreams, but very simple dreams, he's not looking for the world. He's just looking for a better way through the slum, as almost never has a way to reach those dreams. And yet you don't lose hope in this, but it's an eye opener for anyone who thinks that because India is becoming an economic power, Indians are also equally blessed. And so she has just won accolades everywhere. And I think the fact that it won the National Book Award for Nonfiction kind of speaks for itself.
Jill, what's your first pick?
Well, my first pick is my strangest pick. This is the one that I'm getting. And this, in fact, could not only be one of my favorite books of 2012, it may end up being one of my favorite books of 2013, because it is, in fact, a serial novel that is only available online. It is one of the most curious things I've ever come across.
That is so not you.
It is so not me.
You like the book in the hand.
Absolutely. And what is remarkable about this, and it makes me think of what Melanie was saying, how you get books, you know, how you're saying you're sort of always a few years behind. Well, in this case, I'm sort of on the cutting edge. And actually, a fellow employee handed me this article from the Boston Globe about this online novel. Now, right now, this online novel is only available for your iPad or your iPod Touch or your iPhone. So you have to actually buy an app in order to read this story. And it comes in little pieces so that it is one little piece every day. You can read it. You can catch up because right now we're several years into the book, as it were. And apparently it's going to take an entire year to tell the story. But one of the things that is great about it, of course, is they are such little bits, so you don't have to commit a lot to this every day. And the story is basically about a group of children who cannot speak and cannot understand language, and how various people deal with this. And the way it is told is in two different formats, which is one of the intriguing things about it. It is told in what are called testimonials, and this is what you get every day. And the testimonials are presented in the form of oral histories told by characters directly affected by this condition that the children have. So you've got stories from parents and teachers, doctors, faith healers, government officials, everybody who's been affected by these children. And some of them, you only hear their voice once. Others, you're like following a story where the parents are looking for one of these. Sometimes the children go missing. They have to find them. Just sort of heartbreaking stories. But beyond these testimonials, which are the only things at this point that I've read, they also, and because it's online, they can do this, they also have introduced the concept of what they're calling field reports. And the field reports are these short, site-specific accounts that are supposed to deepen your experience of the book. Hmm. And you must be, it's all geolocated, because again, you're doing this with a device, you must be within something like 10 feet of the location in order to actually read the story. And these field reports are being written by people who are reading the book.
Oh, wow.
It's very meta. It's very meta.
Wow.
And the sad thing is there's only one right now. There's only one field report on Cape Cod. I did not write this. This is but there's one in Newcomb Hollow. So I'm trying some point.
You gotta get
I want to get down there and listen to this. But it's a compelling story as well as a really interesting way to deliver it.
It'll be interesting to see how that, you know, how that pans out.
And if
out.
It holds
yeah,
up,
if it holds up.
It's also quite well written.
Well, surprise, as you know, I usually like the nonfiction books, but but I have two picks on my list this year that are based on history, but the historical fiction. And the first one is called The Whip, which is written by Karen Kondazian. And the interesting thing, she's a Hollywood actress. This is her first novel, and I was so surprised for a first novel. She really nailed this. And The Whip is inspired by the true story of a woman who lived most of her life as a man. Charlie Parkhurst, born in 1812, died in 1879, and Charlie became a renowned stagecoach driver for Wells Fargo. A real man, you know? I mean, very... And the surprise was, when he died, they found out that he was a she. So there's really limited information on the real Charlie Parkhurst, and so she creates the story with the little information we have and what Charlie's life might have been. He was the first woman to vote in America as a man. And her grave lives in Watsonville, California. But it was a really great book called The Whip. And just the one, since I'm on the historical fiction, the other one I liked was, and I think you've read this too, Melanie, Terry Arthur's book, Fatal Decision.
Yes.
Edith Cavell, World War One nurse. Yeah. This was a really, I thought, a wonderful book as well. This is the story about the legendary Edith Cavell. Again, it's a novel based on true story. British nurse whose duty as a healer clashed with the demands of a ruthless occupying regime during World War One. This book just... I loved it.
Well, she did an excellent job with the research
did.
Book.
Yeah, well, she found some things that we didn't know.
That's
right.
She actually changed the story because of facts that she found in the depth of her research, which I always think is fascinating.
Yeah, I think there was somebody shot by a firing squad, and where they thought it was, she actually found the actual location when she visited there. But yeah, it was a wonderful book. So those are two picks on my list. What have you got next on yours, Melanie?
Okay, I'm going to move to one that I love so much I don't want to forget it. Even if I have to bypass some others. The Swerve, How the World Became Modern by Stephen Greenblatt. Please, 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 if you love anything about Western literature, Western philosophy, Western art, European art, Dark Ages, Renaissance, antiquities, this is a book that you will love. This is a story of how writings from Roman antiquity were salvaged by monks at the end of the Roman Empire, when the empire was dissolved, basically overrun, then rediscovered by professional book copiers around Europe during the Italian Renaissance. Of particular importance to them was one piece of writing called On the Nature of Things by Lucretius. They knew about this piece, but they had never read the whole thing. And the Renaissance thinkers believed that there was a different way of thinking about the world that the Romans had known that was embedded in this piece of poetry, and they couldn't get at it. And they were not necessarily secularists, but they were thinkers and philosophers, and they were curious. And so they wanted to see the whole picture. And I used to think about this when I was a kid. How would the people in the Dark Ages, you know, poking around at the ground with a stick, look up and see a Roman aqueduct with vines growing on it or whatever? I had a whole mental picture and wonder who those people were who built these things that not only do we not know how to use, we can't build.
Right.
So it always fascinated me. Excuse me. This is the book that answers mm-hmm. that question. He is the Kogan University Professor of Humanities at Harvard, and he wraps ancient Rome, ancient Greece, the destruction of Rome, Pompeii, monastery culture, book copyists, and the rise of private libraries, all of wow. this into a book that, believe it or not, is a page turner. Mm. You can't get enough of this book, and I was absolutely stunned by how drawn in I was by the story and held there. And this book was the winner of the 2012 Pulitzer Prize for Nonfiction and the 2011 National Book Award for Nonfiction. Mm. Highly recommended.
All right. So we're talking about our favorite books of 2012, not necessarily published in 2012, but that we read in 2012. Jill, what's
That's
the next
right.
thing?
That's right. Well, I'm going the really opposite extreme from what Melanie just spoke of. You all know, I'm sure, that one of the big books this year was a book called 50 Shades of Grey.
Oh, boy.
And I read this book. I really disliked this book. And I thought, but this is terrible. You know, all these people are, with huge lists, waiting lists for that book at the library. So I went to, this is again, sort of how do you find out about a book? Well, I went to a publisher's talk, and one of the publishers said, if you hated 50 Shades of Grey, which I did because I thought that the characters were annoying. I thought it was badly written. They were just irritating.
That's what I heard.
That's what you heard.
I didn't even bother.
So she said, if you hated that, the book you want to read is a book called With My Body by Nikki Gemmill, somebody I'd never heard of before. She's an Australian writer. And so I read this book, and I love this book. And I have to say, it is not going to be for everyone. It definitely is erotica, although someone described it as intellectuals erotica. So she quotes a lot. She has quotes from Calvino and Neruda and Emily Bronte and Socrates. So it's very highfalutin, you know, except that it's not. So, and the story, I just will read you a bit of the prologue to give you an idea. And one of the things that you will either love about this book or hate about it, and I found it rather compelling, is she does everything in the second person, which is not normally how people write things. So this is part of the prologue. You begin. It feels right at his desk, on his chair. His typewriter is the only thing left of him in the room. The ink ribbon is fresh, the metal letters cut firm and deep, as if he has placed it for this moment just for you. You start slow, clunking, getting used to the heft of the old way, working laboriously on the beautiful antique machine, for if you make a mistake, you can't go back, and you need these pages methodical, neat. You type with his old Victorian volume by your side that he gave you once, A Woman's Thoughts About Women, that logged within its fields all that happened in this place, that breathed life once. You relive the dialogue of his handwriting and yours jotted in the margins and the back. Don't quite know what you're going to do with all the work. At this stage, you're just collating, filching everything that's needed from this notebook, whose pages are bruised with age and grubbiness and life, luminous life, sweat and ink and rain spots, sap and dirt and ash, the grease from a bicycle and a silvery snail's trail and a cicada wing, its fragile lead-lit tracery. You reap his words and yours, and then the Victorian housewives, her lessons about life, her guiding voice. She will lead you through this. Tell the truth and don't be afraid of it, she soothes. Yes. Now, may I just say that a book that starts with a typewriter and handwriting and Victorian, you know, talking about Victorian book is just sort of, you know, my cup of tea. Now, it may not be yours, but and that I had to immediately look up a word because she refers to something called lead-lit tracery, and the lead-lit refers to lead-light windows. So the fact that I had to look up a word was a good thing right on the first page. And it is basically broken into 225 lessons that she learns. She is a mother. The actual plot of the story is she's a wife, a mother of three. She has everything that she could possibly want, but she's gone numb inside. She's got, you know, locked in that cycle of chores and errands and mealtimes, and she can't find a way to live with her husband. And so in order to figure out how to go on, she remembers back to, to another time, revisiting her past when she met the man of her dreams, which had happened when she was actually in high school. And she tells the story of what happened when she met him. Okay. And so show. It is very, very well written. And again, not for everybody. There are, you know, scenes with blindfolds, so be forewarned.
Let's see. What about next? Martha White, E.B. White's granddaughter. She did this great. She edited her book is Words of E.B. White: Quotations from America's Most Companionable of Writers. This was a lovely book, and lovely just because of the, you know, memories from the granddaughter as well. But some great quotes. I love this. I would really rather feel bad in Maine than feel good anywhere else.
Oh.
And of course, we all remember Charlotte's Web, One Man's Meat, author of The Elements of Style, a columnist for The New Yorker. He's just, of course, a beloved writer, and it was really, really wonderful to you know, see some of his writings. Also, she included some from its essay collections, as well as bits from both published and unpublished letters and journals. So this was really a lovely book that I had to put on my list for my favorites in 2012. What have you got next, Melanie?
Okay. I was one of those people who became a huge fan of Justin Cronin's first novel, The Passage. And not that it was an easy book to read. It's a zombie apocalypse novel. I'll say that right up front.
We just never know what we're going to get.
No, we do not. And I will say that I'm also a huge fan of The Walking Dead. So this is a recurrent theme in this, my fifth, sixth decade. Whatever. It's fun. It's fun stuff. But Justin Cronin is a good, serious writer. And he's actually won some literary awards. So when he came out with the first book, The Passage, I think people were immediately pulled into it because of the quality of the writing, not the fact that it was a zombie apocalypse novel.
Although that didn't hurt, I'm sure.
It didn't hurt. It didn't hurt. They were really fun. And besides, he doesn't call them zombies. They are virals, which opens the door to many other sort of ways of thinking about it. One of the other things that I was curious about this is that he's a Centerville summer resident and then also a professor of creative writing at Rice University in Houston. So he's got his street cred, so to speak. Well, this summer, after 2 years, the second book in the trilogy came out, and it is called The 12. And if anything, this book was a better book in some ways, because I think it was maybe a little more accessible to the average reader. Plus, as complicated as the first book was, hundreds of characters, back and forth in time, activity, new language, that kind of thing. All of that seems to be put to better use in the second book. And he also, I think, USA Today disagrees with this entirely, but I think he found the perfect way to summarize the book at the beginning of the 12. So you don't have to go back and reread. Those of you who are saying, oh, what am I going to do now? I can't go back and reread that. You don't have to. You can start from the beginning here. But this is I can't help it. This is my kind of thing. In fact, probably 50% of what's on my list are people surviving or not. It's just the thing. Here's a very small passage from it. Colorado was gone, basically. Colorado was kaput. Denver, Greeley, Fort Collins, Boulder, Grand Junction, Durango, the thousand little towns in between. The latest aerial intel looked like a war zone. Cars crashed on the highways, buildings burning, bodies everywhere. During daylight hours, nothing seemed to be moving except the birds. Huge, spiraling swarms of them, like the word had gone out from Vulture Central Command. I can't help myself.
Well, and I
love that kind of stuff.
I have to say, I was really looking forward to that book, and I hate to disagree with you, but I could not get through the second volume. And maybe sometimes it's just you're not in the mood for whatever it is.
So true.
Part of it, I think, having read the first volume and really enjoyed it, it felt really repetitive to me. But now that you've suggested it's really,
I may just have
to pick that up again.
All right. What's your next book, Jill?
My next book, again, you never know what we're going to bring. This is a novel called Time Will Darken It by William Maxwell. It was actually published in 1948, but I only read it this year, so new to me. And I just fell in love with this book. I can't even begin to express the sort of beautiful writing that he does and the simple truth that he has in this novel, which is basically about a family in Illinois in a town called Draperville in 1912. And another family comes to visit, and what happens when this other family, when they sort of overstay their welcome. And I went back and read actually the New York Times that was written, the review that was written in 1948 and couldn't help but notice that this book was only $3 when it appeared in 1948. But listen to this. To arrive at some idea of the culture of a certain street in a Middle Western small town shortly before the First World War is a delicate undertaking, runs one meditative chapter ending in this novel. But even more delicate and more difficult is the projection in fiction of the breathing people, the living relationships, the very air and feeling of such a time and place. Yet that is precisely what Mr. Maxwell, in a quiet, accurate way, achieves in Time Will Darken It. And in the story, Austin King, who is the father here, has these relatives show up, and the relatives sort of take over the house. And Martha King, who is his wife, is pregnant and is not very happy with all these relatives. And things get further complicated by the fact by Nora, who is one of the children that comes, but she's actually... I don't know exactly how old she is, but she's sort of 19, 20, something along those lines. And she falls in love with Mr. King, and Mr. King falls a little bit in love with her. And he writes just lyrically of what that meant to all of them. There's a beautiful passage about Martha describing their courtship, her courtship with her husband when she's really, and he puts it right in the middle of the scene where she's like going through his suits and trying to clean up a room, and she suddenly comes, remembers all of this. And then it talks about what Nora wants, this girl, and she's trying to explain to her mother what she wants. And she says, "I want to make my own life," Nora said, raising her knees under the cover and resting her chin on them. "I want to be among people who do things instead of merely existing. I want to see snow. I don't know what I want." And he just writes these gorgeous sentences. I could read more. I won't. But he also has inanimate objects sort of respond to what's happening in a scene. So at one point, he's after Nora has again said this beautiful speech to the father of the household, and the next line is, "Very," said the typewriter in the outer office. So the typewriter is responding to her speech.
That's funny.
Really gorgeous, lovely novel.
That's very unusual.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
It is.
Well, my next pick is nonfiction, and you talk about surviving, Melanie. If you haven't read this, you would I think enjoy this, Holocaust Remembrance Day. Have either of you read that book? Joe Thomas and Martha McCabe edited "Branded on My Arm and in My Soul," a Holocaust memoir by Abraham Landau. And Abe Landau spent 5 years in labor and concentration camps in the early 1940s, and he survived this nightmare. And it's just really a miracle, and just the insight into, you know, what he went through, the times that he just, by the luck of being in the right place at the right time, and you know, how he survived, and then to come to New Bedford and rebuild his life as a tailor, cantor, activist, founder of the Holocaust Memorial in New Bedford. A remarkable story, how he met his wife, what he meant to the community of New Bedford. It was just a really beautiful book.
Well, I'm going to pull out another nonfiction myself, because actually the balance of reading I do anymore is nonfiction. It's got to be a pretty good novel for me to go there. And this is called The Long Walk, A Story of War and the Life That Follows, by Brian Kastner. And Kastner is a returned Iraq and Afghanistan war veteran who knows he sustained irreparable brain damage. He says it right up front in the book. "I'm crazy now, and I know it, and there's nothing that can be done about it." And yet he's able to write this incredible book. He was a bomb disposal expert. So the number of concussions and concussive events that he underwent, even protected with gear, were so many that after a while they started realizing there was a pattern, that the sheer number of concussive events led down a path from which there was no coming back. Mm. So he's not alone in this diagnosis. And he says that many of the returning veterans from both of those wars are suffering from a particular kind of brain damage from these concussive events, which I think medically we're just starting to get a handle on. The thing is with this book is this is absolutely beautifully written. And he's so honest and he's so clear. And you wonder in what ways his brain is damaged that he knows he's crazy. But he's very clear about that. He is not the same person now at all as he was before. And it's a heartbreaking book, but it's also an open door to what so many of our veterans are experiencing that many of them do not have the words to explain. Brian Kastner does. And I really recommend this book as a way to – it will explain a lot of what we see in the news.
Big understanding, yeah.
Huge understanding.
Right. Jill.
I've got a perfect for a snowy winter's day read. I think this book is, it's not great fiction, but it's a great read. It's a great story. It's called The Forgotten Garden by Kate Morton. And it basically involves, it starts in 1913. A little girl arrives in Brisbane, Australia. She's taken in by a dock master and his wife. She doesn't know her name. And the only clue to her identity is a book of fairy tales tucked inside a white suitcase. And when this girl grows up, Nell, she starts to piece together her story. And on her 21st birthday, she discovers that the people she thinks are her parents are not her parents. Mm. And she starts trying to trace back. And what happens in this story is that it is really set in three different time frames. You've got 1913 when she's little, 1976 when she's trying to find out the story, and then in 2005 her granddaughter tries to find out the story. So it goes back and forth, shifts between. And if you have ever read and loved The Secret Garden by Frances Burnett, there is a fabulous little story about that novel in here as well.
All right, my final book here is Mick Carlin, who you probably know as a school teacher in Barnstable. He's a jazz fanatic, author of two novels, and my favorite, Riding on Duke's Train. He wrote two of them, Riding on Duke's Train and Travels with Lewis. Riding on Duke's Train, the musicians are all real in the story, but he has a young boy who ends up traveling along with the Duke Ellingtons and his group in the 1939 European tour. So again, based on reality, but it is fiction, and it's for young readers, but I really enjoyed it. And I think, you know, if you've got some young readers that you'd like to introduce to jazz, either of these books are great. Travels with Lewis are, of course, about Louis Armstrong. And this is, again, a youngster who gets to experience Lewis in the 1960s. And I found out he likes to be called Lewis. He didn't like Louis. He liked Lewis. So Mick Carlin, Riding on Duke's Train.
Okay, quickly, one nonfiction book, Eating Dirt by Charlotte Gill. Ever wonder who replants the trees when we are told that a forest has been reforested? It's these people. And they are given a dropped off sometimes by helicopter, given a bag of seedlings, and off they go. And they must deal with everything that the wilderness throws at them. A book I was fascinated with because I never knew who these people were.
Yeah, we have books we didn't get to, but will we put them on the list?
We sure will.
So you can check out our list at capeandislands.org. Click on the point, and we'll have a link to all three of our favorite reads for 2012. Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and Melanie Lowers, books editor at the Cape Cod Times. Always goes by too fast. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point airs weekdays at 9:30 a.m. and 7:30 p.m. We're also on Facebook at The Point, WCAI. The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.